Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, it is the Writer's Block. It's Sunday. It's 10 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, in the evening here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. It's cold. It's dark. It's bleak. And I can hear gunfire outside. It's just one of those evenings, I tell you, folks. And here with me, I have someone who is no stranger to neighborhood gunplay, the Z-Man of the Z-Block, coming in from Lagos on the Chesapeake. We have the indomitable Z-Man, the Z-Man of the hour. How are you doing, fine sir?
I'm doing well. I hope everyone's doing well. It's an evening where you are. Actually, it's evening here. It's 4 o'clock in Lagos time. Well, no gunfire tonight. Sunday's usually a slow night here for murdering people. For whatever reason, it's just, you know, they're probably just worn out from the weekend, you know, Friday night, Saturday night. You know, we've had an uptick in murders here recently. We fell behind our record-setting pace, but, you know, the holiday time's a good time to, you know, pop a cap in a relative, and so we hope we can break the record. We're not going to catch St. Louis this year for murder rate, sadly enough. They're going to take the gold, but, you know, we'll take the silver.
Yeah. Well, I hear that the native wildlife of Lagos does not much appreciate cold weather and the early arriving night, so that may be a factor there. And, of course, it's very difficult to rile them up to violence over... well, unless one of their own has been gunned down in righteous self-defense. Speaking of righteous self-defense, oh, but I might have forgotten to say a thing or two about donations. You can, of course, donate to this stream and ask me questions, ask the Z-Man questions, ask both of us questions, or you can just give us money to insult us. We're not opposed to that. On Entropy, just go to entropystream.live/countercurrents or click the link helpfully provided by our heroic moderators in the DLive and Odyssey chats. If our heroic moderators would just step up to the bat and just post that in the link, that would be greatly appreciated. And of course, this stream is as always supported by Alaska Chaga, the beverage of the Great White North, the real Great White North, the remnants of Russian America here in this cup. And this is the first time I'm making it from loose chaga chunks instead of tea bags. That's because I ran out of tea bags and I've been dreading this moment, but it tastes divine. There's just no loss of taste. I think even the smell may be enhanced. Now, the Alaska Chaga guy warned me not to eat the chaga chunks. Now, I'm the type of person you have to warn not to eat the chaga chunks. But we'll see what we can do. I'm just going to be drinking away. Z, I hear you appreciate a cup of chaga as well.
Yeah, you know, it's I never actually heard of the stuff until he sent me a big care package of it. And, you know, I've experimented around with doing different things. And when I'm learning about this stuff, people actually really want the antioxidants because it's a really mild flavor. So I've actually started, I take a regular old tea bag, you know, the regular conventional, actually an English breakfast tea I like. And then I throw a chaga tea bag in there and then, you know, put them together. Because I say the chaga, you know, it's got a really, I guess a mild flavor is the word for it. But I also put Jack Daniels in it, so...
That's very interesting. The old Irish curse, from what I understand.
Well, you know, I really, Jack Daniels and conventional iced tea is it's probably a Southern thing, I guess, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it's not uncommon. A lot of people do it, or any kind of bourbon, you know, you wouldn't want to use good bourbon like, you know, Knob Creek or something like that, but you know, the cheaper stuff, it's a nice summertime drink. Although this time of year, it's kind of cold here now. So I'm back to warm tea.
That's very interesting. Now, I've heard it somewhere that basically tea in the South is a very different animal from tea elsewhere in the world. So if you would just comment on that, just clear up something for a foreigner.
Yeah, in American South, you drink sweet tea. You know, it's not it's just a different way of doing it, I guess. I don't know. But cold sweet tea. Although, you know, you have in New England, people drink cold coffee, iced coffee with cream in it. So cream and sugar, you know, cold coffee. So, you know, America's a big country. You know, we've always been multicultural and multi-ethnic and multiracial. All kinds of weird stuff goes on here in terms of regional weirdness. And in the South, sweet tea, that's what people drink. It's so common. If you ask for tea that's unsweetened, they'll just assume that you've had brain damage.
That's very interesting. Also very interesting is that according to Orwell, the English working class is literally addicted to sweetened tea. And it's basically what keeps them hopped up on, let's just call them uppers, the caffeine in the tea, four spoons of sugar per cup, from what I understand. And this is what keeps them from revolting. Of course, the working class have always and everywhere been utterly revolting. But we'll get back to that. We have topics to discuss. Now, as the audience is sure to know, we take questions. You can donate on DLive. You can donate lemons on DLive. And you can also donate one of those strange library coins or whatever they call them on Odyssey. If you are on Odyssey, we accept them all. We will answer questions posed with all. But of course, the absolute champions ring of donations is on Entropy, and those questions are 100% certain to get answered. And so I think we can segue into the topic which has been on everyone's tongue this past few days. Kyle Rittenhouse, he got away from it. You mean he's walking free? The judge says to him, "Hey, kid, you forgot something," tosses him his AR. Kyle walks out of that courtroom to the sound of, choose your patriotic 80s glam rock. I believe you have opinions on that, Z. What is your take, as the kids say, on the Rittenhouse thing?
Well, you know, I have a post tomorrow in Tackies that'll cover this in more detail, but this is one more item in this sort of trial on some basic elements of what it means to be an American. And it's harder for perhaps Europeans to understand some of this stuff because there's some subtext here that's really peculiar to America. The gun culture, for example. You know, if you go and look at German social media, for example, there's a lot of people who are absolutely baffled at the idea of people walking in the streets with firearms. Well, in America, that's not weird. You know, we just have this culture. You know, I've pointed out to people, America is 4% of the world's population. We own almost 60% of the known firearms in existence. So that's how strong the gun culture is here. It's just so powerful, and it crosses all the boundaries. You know, the reason why gun grabbing doesn't get very far is because even people on the left say, well, that's too far. We can't go there. They'll put up with the howler monkeys who scream about guns and all this stuff, but they tend not to act on it because whenever they do, it's a horrible pushback for them. Back, I guess last year or so, maybe a year and a half, in one of the American states in Virginia, they started making noises about passing gun laws. The left got control of the legislature. Oh, we're going to do gun laws. Well, 50,000 people showed up in the state capitol saying, no, you're not. You're not going to do this. And they backed off. They had no choice, really. And this happens everywhere. And that's a big part of, you know, the media doesn't talk about it because they don't know how to. But there was a big subtext there. I guarantee you that a lot of those people in Kenosha County, which voted for Trump, by the way, that county, they go to the range, their kids hunt, their grandfathers took them hunting. You know, the gun culture is there. But there's another piece here that's really not, it's related to the gun culture, and that is integral to the American identity has always been this sort of frontier mentality that ultimately you have to be able to defend you. Self-defense is an enormous part. We have no duty to retreat in this country. There are no states that say you've got to make a good faith effort to retreat against your attacker. And in fact, many states have laws that specifically protect you for standing your ground. You know, they tried to smear these laws by calling them, you know, these stand your ground laws. And people said, yeah, you should be able to stand your ground. There was no moral purchase there. You know, in Britain, for example, they passed laws.
I always thought that was a selling point. I always liked the idea of standing your ground. Even the phrase itself sounds heroic.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, in most states that have, like concealed carry permits, where when you get your permit, they explain to you that you can stand your ground, and then when that person gets within, say, 21 feet, 7 yards, you're allowed to take them out. That's the shooting distance. They actually train you to do this. The state police will come into your class and say, and teach you to tell the difference, you know, 7 yards or, you know, 7 meters for you guys. But so you learn this. And this is just a part of the American psyche. And when these guys, when that video came out, there were even some left-wing people who were starting to see these videos and stuff. It's amazing. There's this group called the Young Turks. There's some Armenian woman who was there. She came out and flipped sides because she said, I didn't realize that the people he shot were white. She thought he went hunting black people because she paid attention to the New York Times. But then when she actually saw the facts, she completely spun the other way. She said, well, of course, what he did was perfectly legitimate. You know,
I wouldn't call him white, but those guys were not black. And this just shows us that basically she did not even, at the time when the Rittenhouse thing happened in Kenosha, I only gave it, you know, a perfunctory look, because to me it was just one minor thing in the grander BLM Antifa rioting, attempting to burn down America. But even my perfunctory reading into it revealed to the, well, these people, they're not blacks, which he shot, that they were, you know, two of them were, are Jewish, Rosenbaum and Huber, and one was, I guess, Gage Grosskreutz was white. It's difficult in the Midwest because I was commenting on it with friends who don't really know the demographic situation of the Great Lakes region, and like, why do these people have German names? Are they old Jews? And like, no, that's Wisconsin and Illinois, a lot of people are actual honest to God Germans there. You know, you have Rittenhouse and Schroeder and Grosskreutz and Huber, names like this. And you don't know if they're Germans or Jewish, you know, just from the names. It's not like Anglo America. This is the core of German America where this is happening.
Yeah,
but even from a perfunctory look at it, you know, I knew those guys were not black. So this tells you the degree to which this woman lives in a media bubble.
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, it's, they have their own reality, and I've used this example before. If you're a fan of the French Revolution, one of the things that jumps out the more you read about it is how the aristocracy during that period was a black box to everybody. No one could figure out why they were doing the things they were doing. Now, the people inside had a set of logical rules, and what they were doing made sense based on those rules. Outside those rules, they didn't make any sense at all. But the opposite was true as well. The aristocracy was largely divorced from what was happening in the world. It was shocking to some degree, the things that they did, because they just didn't know. They had no idea. And we've run into this as well. We've been actually in America having this problem for quite some time. Our media is amazingly divorced from reality. They only talk to each other. They operate in a bubble. There's whole swaths of reality that is completely outside their zone of understanding. It's beyond their event horizon. And it's getting bigger. It's getting bigger and bigger. You know, I've had opportunities in the Imperial Capital to talk to people who live in that world. And it's, we may as well live in completely different, you know, universes. And I mean, it's a problem that's happened in the universities. Years ago, I was on the campus of Yale and ran into this. I had a friend who was doing post-grad work there. And you talk to these grad students, they'd never been off the college campus. They had no idea what the world was like outside their own border. And they had no interest in learning. They wanted to stay in that world. That's the other piece of it. Our media and these people like this Young Turks woman or whatever, this escapism, this world they live in, it becomes less and less realistic in order to make them feel safer. And so they're becoming even more divorced from reality. I watched a clip of her. I guess that was about 2 weeks ago. Maybe it was longer ago. But it was hilarious to watch. She's having this revelation. It's like, oh, my God, I just looked out this thing called a window. And there's stuff outside, you know. And it really was an amazing thing to watch. And But I think getting back to this whole Rittenhouse thing, I know a lot of people, and I talked about this on my secret podcast today, that were, I think some of our side kind of thought it would be better if he became a martyr. But you know what? Winning is winning. And what it tells me when you start looking at this, Chauvin was sent to prison for the rest of his life as a practical reality in a part of the country that went for Joe Biden like 68% of the vote, something like that. Trump got like 22% of the vote. The Kenosha County, this kid was found not guilty by a jury that was about 52-53% Trump. So there's a lot of sensible people out there who, look, these people, they threatened them. They sent the media there to try and dox them. They threatened the judge. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that went on that, you know, kind of started leaking out, and they held their ground. So we need to look and realize that, hey, you know what? There's still a lot of decent people who, if you push them hard enough, you push them, their back to the wall, their back will get stiff. They're not going to crumble. And that's a good thing. That's what we want. We want more people to do that. And, you know, so you have to take the good news where you can find it. And I think this is generally good news. And also, as a decent human being, as someone who doesn't want to live in a world full of sociopaths, I'm happy that this baby-faced kid, because he's a young man for sure, but he's a kid, is not going to be spending the rest of his life wrestling gorillas behind a cage. You know, I don't want to see that happen.
It's an interesting thing to look at it. I mean, let's not forget that the racial dynamics are different from the Chauvin case. Chauvin dared transgress against a diverse American, against a basketball American, then they are sacred. And as Anna Kasparian so helpfully informed us, Kyle was shooting at quote-unquote white guys, which is, I guess, okay. I will, however, point out that there is a parallel case going on in Oregon where a white guy is on trial for defending himself and his girlfriend from being assaulted by a black man who, you know, bragged about considering women with white boyfriends single because fuck Timmy gonna do. Well, he fucked around, he found out, but now the white guy who defended his girlfriend from sexual assault by a black man, he's now facing murder charges. And of course, parallel to this, we have the jogger case. The guys, the McMichaels, and, you know, today it was Orthodox Saint Michael's Day, so I'm going to pray for those guys. The McMichaelses in Georgia who nabbed the jogger. Remember the jogger? Oh, I love that meme. And if anyone has the Pepe sticker still on DLive, I would greatly appreciate it if you, the one where Pepe is jogging with work boots and hammer, I would greatly appreciate if you would just dump it into the chat so I can re-add it to my library. They are still on trial, and this means that if they are convicted, it's going to set a very dangerous precedent that, yeah, it's okay to have self-defense, but only if you're defending yourself against someone who is not black, preferably white or white presenting, you know. And I'm going to write a full-length article for Countercurrents on my thoughts with regard to this thing. But I don't know. Do you see it that way, that this could be the first step towards a dangerous precedent which allows self-defense but only against, you know, white presenting people?
In my award-winning tacky column on Monday, I actually go through this, quite a few of these, because this is not the only stuff. There's a lot of these. And I think in retrospect, we're going to look at this time in America as when this is the bridge too far. There are certain things that you're not allowed to question. You know, the Greeks used to have a thing where they would agree upon something, the ancient Greeks, and say, okay, if we're not just going to agree upon this, we're going to ban any disagreement about this. This is now integral to who we are. And if someone comes up and says, I want to challenge this now, this new orthodoxy, well, we're going to throw them off a cliff. And that's the end of it. You know, you get the death penalty for questioning it. And, you know, we don't do that in Western societies for a very long time, but the concept is there. There are certain things that are just off limits. You don't do. I'm old enough to remember when attacking free speech or any kind of political speech was considered anathema. You just didn't do it. It wasn't done. Even, you know, the worst person saying the worst things had to be tolerated, because, I mean, I remember having this drilled into my head in school, because that's the price of freedom. You know, these concepts are all on trial now. I mean, that Charlottesville circus, which is completely ridiculous, everything about it, all the people are ridiculous. The very idea that it's happening is ridiculous. But what is really going on? They're saying, well, we can't ban directly speech from people we don't like. we're simply going to threaten them with financial ruination. We're going to establish this system that, hey, if you say something in the political arena that makes someone sad, they'll take your house away. Well, you have free speech, but you lose your house. Well, congratulations. That right doesn't have any meaning. And of course, they're doing this in other ways where they attack venues and say, well, what we're going to do is if you have this event, if a group of people get together, you know, you're going to have an event. Well, we'll burn down the facility. So in order to protect the facility, you have to have insurance, and no insurance company will give you insurance. So you can't have the event. I mean, this is actually what's happening. This is the scheme that's happening. And of course,
no, they're talking about mandatory liability insurance for events.
Yep, exactly. So you have all these things. And all of this is about is basically the totalitarian, you know, cultural Marxist push to strip everyone of their ancient rights and accomplish. It's funny with these guys, the old Marxists and the new Marxists, their dreamed of future is always very gauzy. And it's this avatar out there on the horizon that you really can't define. But they know they're willing to murder as many people as possible, destroy as much as possible in order to achieve it. And I, you know what, the point of my tacky post, and I'm going to, this is something I'll be talking about a lot, is that what we've got to come to terms with is that the people who brought this case against Rittenhouse, let's just use them. These are not people I want to be in the same country with. These are not people should ever have access to power. Yeah. These are not people should ever have any authority. These are bad people. And, you know, the libertarians under, was it Hans Hermann Hoppe? He always talked about, I think he's still alive, that the only way you could have a libertarian society is that when someone came along and started talking about democracy or communism, you physically remove them from your society. This is the thing that we're looking at right now. We're looking at having to physically remove people from our society because this is what's happening. You know, I don't want to relitigate basic rules of civilization. If that's going to be what happens, then the gloves come off. They have to.
Yeah, I remember that. And I remember that's the first step a lot of our guys took into the distant right. The notion that if you want to keep your liberties, if you want to keep your rights, if you want to keep living in a sane society, you know, like libertarians are, we dunk on them, you and me both, but these are, for the most part, 108 plus IQ white guys with, you know, a few, if any, social skills, but 108 plus IQ white guys. That's my tribe. I love those guys. But the only way their society is feasible is if they live in the shadow of a state willing to physically remove these people. We can call them witches. We can call them cultural Marxists. We can call them all sorts of names, but we know of whom we speak. And these people have to be, we don't have to, you know, ex-nay them, but we are probably going to have to ship them over to an area where they can live by themselves. I hear they have a country now in the Middle East. But anyways, we have donations. We have donations on Entropy, and we have the first question of the night from Scott, who seeks to drive a wedge between two respected movement figures. I don't know if this is tendentious or if he just wants information. He asks for $20. Nick, in the Millennial Woes Telegram group. Old wounds are being opened. The Z-Man said that the Rittenhouse trial does not concern Europeans because they have neither a gun culture nor a right to self-defense. That means you, a Macedonian, have no business discussing the trial. Can you make sense of this? A bizarre logic. Now, Scott, I appreciate the $20, but I don't think you're representing Z-Man's words as they were told. Z, would you care to defend yourself from this heavy charge?
Yeah, I mean, my experience in Europe has been this. Europeans obsess over America to the point of to their own detriment. And it's bizarre as an American, because the typical American just assumes we don't know doodly squat about the world outside our own backyard. We just accept this. This is not, we're perfectly happy being provincial bumpkins who wear raccoon hats or, you know, we wear pots on our head. We understand this. We take some pride in being rustic in our sensibilities. But yet, when you deal with Europeans, they will oftentimes, not always, of course, but oftentimes they will carry on as if they know more about America than we do. And they get all this stuff through the media. And this isn't a story I use where I had a couple of Irish guys telling me what was really happening in Baltimore, where I live, that because they saw The Wire. I was gobsmacked by this. I'm like, you have no idea what the hell you're talking about, you know. But this happens a lot, and I think it's particularly true in the English-speaking countries. I don't know if it's true. It's not as true in Scandinavia, my experience, but in the English-speaking countries, they become virtual Americans or vicarious Americans. Really, in other words, they want to be American, and they do it vicariously through the media, you know, the internet and cable TV and satellite TV and all this stuff. And that's kind of what I was getting at with these guys who were in Woe's orbit. It's like, stop obsessing about this. None of the issues at play here really have anything to do with Britain. You don't have a gun culture. You don't have this self-defense culture. You don't have this frontier mentality. These are not the subtext of this story is not really applying to you guys. You should spend your time worrying about things that actually matter. You know, one of the guys I enjoy following is Morgoth. Why is that? He talks about stuff that actually matters to him and his own community. That's what nationalists in Europe need to worry about. And I think a lot of them do, for sure. Your old partner there, what's his name? He's going to hate me for not remembering. Yeah. You know, they do this thing with where they have all these different nationalists from Europe on, and, you know, they do various shows and talk about different issues. That's great. That's what you should be doing. You know, the Poles should care about Poland. Now, sure, in the general issues like immigration, yeah, sure, I would know something about. I mean, we would joke about Africans washing up in the glamorous beaches of the Mediterranean. You know, I mean, and it's ridiculous because, look, we have the same problem. We have Haitians that wash up on our beaches, you know. Sure, there's similar things, but we're different people. We have different challenges and different problems. And I think far too many Europeans, instead of facing up to what's happening in their backyard, it's let me worry about what's happening in an ocean away and obsess over that to the point of distraction. And I know that those guys don't like hearing that because it's a lot easier and a lot more fun to care about stuff that's 3,000 miles away than it is to worry about the fact that, you know, where you live now is going to be invaded by whoever the British government, whoever Boris Johnson wants to import now. I don't know. I've kind of lost track of that. But, you know, because one is hard and one is easy, you know, because it's easy to be a vicarious American when you're 3,500 miles away.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with your way of thinking here. As to specifically in Macedonia, like Europe is not a uniform place. If Z said that, it's probably a joke. But I was just today, I was looking at, you know, gun ownership rates in Europe, and Macedonia is great. We're doing above average. We also have, I wouldn't call it a gun culture, but we have a hunting culture. And that's something I wanted to comment on about. From the gun-owning cultures of Europe, I've never really seen anyone speak of a gun culture. There is a hunting culture. There is a farming culture and a shepherding culture. Like, a lot of people in Macedonia own long guns for the purposes of shooting wolves, because wolves, they prey on farm animals. And a lot of people have... you know, I think they keep birdshot for rabbits, because rabbits will eat the agricultural stuff. Where we were talking about tobacco with the Z man before we started. I don't know if rabbits eat tobacco though. Anyways, you know, there are a lot of guns in Macedonia, a lot of privately owned guns, and especially long guns. And I'm not just talking about shotguns here, but there is no gun culture to speak of. There's a hunting culture, and there is a farming culture, but it's not focused around the gun as a physical thing, but around the hunt or the farming as an activity. And I was also looking at the gun ownership rates of the rest of Europe, and it seems to correlate strongly with basically mountaineer culture. You look at Switzerland and Northern Italy, Finland, Sweden, Norway. So these are all places where wild animals, and especially wolves, can come, assault you in the middle of winter. Macedonia, Serbia, Bosnia, this is also very prevalent here. You have wildly tall mountains where wild animals live, and they can endanger animals, they can endanger people. And I don't know, we have a lot of Finns in chat usually, so if they would opine about it, We can maybe have a comparison. A lot of people in Scandinavia are private gun owners, but there's nothing quite like American gun culture. And I will agree. That's why, I mean, this content I produce for people's benefit in America, in the United Kingdom, because I speak the language, I understand the culture, but I also have a unique perspective because I am an outsider. But on my own time, in my free time, I actually do a lot of work here in Macedonia. As people may know, I have run for parliament here, lost horribly, but at least I did something, right? I've been engaged in other political activities, and that's the primary thing I'm doing. This is, you know, I mean, I love you guys. I love this show. I love doing it. But the future of my people is not going to be decided in Kenosha. That's like, I don't even know where Kenosha is on a map to this day. I didn't even bother looking it up. I know it's where Kyle shot those guys. It's,
Well, the other thing about the Balkans in general, I think, is that the history there has required a sense of community defense. And, you know, Montenegro has the highest gun ownership rate in Europe. And it's funny. It's not even really close. You know, second is pretty far behind. But why? What's
very heavily mountainous. Montenegro. Yeah, I mean, so it's right in the name.
And you know, in that part of the world, to rely on for a long, long time to think that, hey, somebody from the state, somebody with official authority is going to come and help resolve this dispute was unrealistic. So you have to, you know, do it yourself. And of course, that's really the frontier culture of America. But in particularly Central Europe, where central authority has just been a way of life, it's less so. But I mean, it's, you know, I think sometimes Americans make the mistake of thinking that the European view of firearm ownership makes them, you know, means they're homosexuals or something. And that's not really, it's just a different attitude for it. You know, I know that fans live outside.
It could be selection bias, because you will be hearing in English from highly educated Europeans who follow American media. And with the exception of me and Europeans in the dissident right, these will be, you know, it will be basically like getting your opinions on America from Woody Allen. So it could be just selection bias. Just the European opinions which trickle over the Atlantic are the Europeans of the worst quality. The opinions of the worst quality Europeans.
Sure. Yeah. It's one of those things that I always tell people. If you're going to, a lot of people ask me, you know, hey, I want to go to Europe first time. Where should I go? I say, well, you know, go to an English speaking country. You know, you'll have fun in Ireland, and it's easy. You don't have to worry about the language barrier, and they love American tourists and all that. But I also always tell them that, make sure you turn on their cable news channels, because you'll then realize that ours is just as absurd and ridiculous. The ridiculousness of it, I mean, you just laugh at it. It's so silly. Mm-hmm. And you realize, well, wait a second, my stuff is actually as crappy as this stuff. So it's a good perspective thing. And, you know, you guys suffer from the same problem with the media that we suffer from. It's full of lies, you know. But the thing about the gun culture thing is that I think, you know, for Americans, you know, and I know some people probably in the chat say, well, the younger people are not like this. Well, you know what? If you actually go to a range on a regular basis, you see fathers and sons, you see young groups of people coming in to learn to shoot. I started shooting when I was probably six, something like that. It's a thing that gets done all the time. And it's not just a father and son thing. I mean, a lot of women are in shooting in this where I live. And it's not unusual to have gun dates. I've gone on gun dates where you go on a date with a woman. And I remember talking to this girl. She said, you know, it's a kind of a good kind of first test, because if the guy says he's afraid of guns, you don't want anything to do with him. You know, it's one of those things, you know. And
I don't know. Women shooting, it's
women can be very feminine. Shooters. I learned, I went to do some training on skeet shooting, skeet and trap. And a 16-year-old girl was a, you know, U.S. National team. And she gave me pointers. She was very good. But her father was also some poobah in Washington in politics. You know, that's the thing about the gun culture, is it just transcends everything. If you go outside of Washington, D.C., there's this huge gun range. It's called the PG Shooting Center. And it's right near the Goddard Space Center. So you'll have all these, you know, guys, you know, the slide rule guys out there, but you also have all the politicos out there. They're all there, and they all have, a lot of them will have very expensive shotguns because the whole skeet thing is a very class thing. You know, it's got that whole country.
What is skeet shooting anyways?
Shooting clays. You know, the little round clays.
I get it. Okay.
Yeah, skeet, trap, and they got a bunch of variations on it. And, you know, it's wing shooting. And, of course, around this area, we have places where if you're a rich guy, you can go down to our shore. You've got duck blinds that have been owned for generations for wing shooters, pheasant hunts. You know, it's just a huge part of what America is. But it's just something we take for granted. But there's parts of it, though, in Europe, though. The Finns have some of this. The Finns are comfortable with firearms, and it's why, you know, they've had probably, man for man, the best military on the planet. You know, they read about the Winter War. It's an amazing thing. They teach our soldiers. We learn lessons from, still to this day, about small unit tactics that come out of the Winter War. But, and I think the Swedes and the Norwegians, but a lot of it's urban, too, you know. 90% of Sweden lives in cities. Well, firearm ownership is less practical in a city than it is out in the country, so you'll have less of it.
Yeah, a firearm ownership in Europe as well also tends towards the long gun, right? The hunting rifle, the shotgun. And I was thinking, you know, let's get something for self-defense, but I would have to join a hunting society or register as a farmer in order to, and this is very interesting. It's far easier in Macedonia to obtain a hunting rifle, you know, the kind that Lee Harvey Oswald used to do God's work, than it is to get a pistol. But it would just not be practical for self-defense. You're walking around with a pistol, and of course there is no concealed carry. There is no open carry either. What am I going to do? I'm going to walk around with a shotgun? Not going to happen. So unless I'm a hunter, I really have no interest in owning firearms here. And that's, I believe, part of it. Rural Europeans, well, the village, and I think it's because a bigger portion of America is rural, this could be an element too. Because the village does not forgive being unarmed. See, that's the thing. Wolves, wild animals, someone mentioned wild hogs in the chat on Odyssey. As someone who has been on the wrong end of a wild boar, I can tell you, I wish I had a gun at that time. I wish I had a high caliber rifle, because a pistol probably would have just pissed it off. And I'm not ashamed to say I ran downhill, which was stupid. I probably could have broken my leg, you know, falling down, but I got away from the boar.
Here in Lagos, we have a type of wild animal that's very dangerous as well, but you know, and you can't outrun them, at least not if you're of my complexion. So it's a different problem. But no, I mean, it's a funny thing about the whole gun culture thing. And it is a uniquely American thing for sure. And I think a lot of Europeans will struggle with it to some degree. In the same way in which we probably struggle with, and I know I struggle with this, the strange aversion Europeans have to country life. A guy I know in this thing, his wife is from Bulgaria. And she finds it completely bizarre that, high status means living out in a rural setting, while low status means living in a city. She finds it completely baffling. But, of course, we find it baffling to you guys. We're like, why would you want to, you know, be packed into these places? Now, your cities are much better than ours, and that's a different thing. So,
yeah, I was talking about this with Hopper Perspective privately. I mean, he's in the chat right now, but I was talking to him, like, and I was telling people, anyone who would listen, you don't hate cities. You hate blacks. Specifically, you don't really hate them as hate. You hate living around them and the effluvia of their crime and their smells and their quote-unquote culture. It's not that cities are inherently evil. You walk around a European city, it's a very pleasant experience. Excepting Marseille, Paris, Frankfurt, these places, London. If you're walking around a white city, it's, you understand, this is a place of great culture, and this is actually a factor, especially in Eastern Europe. Living in the downtown area of a large city is considered very prestigious, right? I live in downtown Skopje, and everything is within walking distance. I think to myself just how much money I'm saving on gas every year, you know, and maybe I'm giving it away on socks and shoes because I go through them like candy, but it's amazing. There's like whole weeks could pass and I won't turn on my car because there's no need to. everything is here. Everything is within 500 meters or less. And that's the privilege of having no non-whites in the inner city, I guess. I got to check my privilege.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Last time I was in Copenhagen, which is my favorite city. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I just love the place. I always stay right on the water. It's a great little place. It used to be a fish house or something. It's like in Finland. I stay in the former jail, the Helsinki jail. They turned it into like a bed and breakfast. So it's convenient. But I was walking around with this Danish girl that I had met, and we were just, you know, doing the tourist thing, and I was doing my thing. And she says, "Well, what do you like about Copenhagen?" I said, "It's quiet." And no, you know, when you were in an American city, it's just so loud. It's just, I mean, you know, especially a place like Lagos, people don't realize how loud these people are. They're loud all the time. They'll stand across the street screaming at each other instead of one of them walking across the street to have a normal conversation. It's just the way it is. And you walk around Copenhagen, it's so relaxing because it's quiet. You know, Danes are a quiet people. They don't like loud noises. You know, they don't want to make big scenes, you know, and that's great. You walk around, you're like, man, this is the way it should be. You know, we need some way to make people quiet in America.
Yeah. Yeah. And for any newcomers who may not be hip to the lingo here, Z does not live in Lagos, Nigeria. No, he lives in Lagos, Maryland, Lagos on the Chesapeake, which will apparently not surpass Memphis as the murder capital of America. But, you know, hope springs eternal. You're going to have to pick up the slack yourself, Z. I think that there are some jobs that have to be done by a disgruntled white man. We could dispatch Kyle. But anyways.
Well, anyway. He has plenty on the murder rate stuff. I was talking to a Brit, and he says, I don't understand. You know, we have violent cities. I said, well, you have to understand something. Your most violent city is about 1/20th as violent as Baltimore. You know, it's Helsinki is about the same size as Baltimore. We'll have 350 murders. They'll have 10. You know, that's the difference. I mean, that's an enormous difference, you know, and our murders are pointless. They're Ray Ray and Peanut getting a beef, and Ray Ray decides to start blasting, and he doesn't actually hit Peanut. He hits three other people, and one of them dies. I mean, that is the commonest of story. It's just stupid people being stupid. And, you know, and it's, look, I, to some degree, people are surprised when I say this. I feel sorry for them. They are in an element for which they are not equipped to operate. It would be like taking one of us and putting us in some alien spaceship that, you know, is a 3,000 years advanced technology and expecting us to be able to operate it. We'll just get terribly frustrated. Mm-hmm. It's the same problem. You know, I mean, it's cruel what we do to Black people in America in trying to make them do things that they don't want to do and live a way they don't want to live. And I think a big part of their violence it comes from that.
I think this is the most unique perspective you can give, Z, because I heard you mention growing up working class in Virginia in the old South and around a lot of Black people. And so I think that you have a unique insight into Black people, right? Especially among the dissident right, which this is like not official, but I notice a lot of dissidents come from blue areas, which, you know, were busted out. We mentioned Full Moon. He was born in a city which at the time of his birth was majority white and was then rapidly brownified due to the actions of a certain idol, which Republicans blasphemously worship. And I think that he doesn't really have a cool-headed perspective of what Blacks really are, because people in the distant right tend not to have a realistic perspective of Blacks, whereas you, because you grew up around them, and I, because I'm safely across the ocean from them, we can be a little bit more objective about that. Like, you know, you are close, I'm really far away, whereas someone of middle distance from Blacks doesn't really understand them.
Well, I mean, there's never a time in my life where I wasn't around Black people. When I was a kid growing up, my first friend in school was a Black kid. They sat us alphabetically. His name was W and mine was Z. So now our parents would certainly be, what, you know, in retrospect, would have been a little uneasy about this friendship because, you know, this was post segregation and all that. But but probably not all that much. People in the South who grew up in the American South at all, especially the Deep South, they're rubbing elbows with the other race all the time. There's an old expression in America, and that is, in the Northeast, white people are willing to treat black people as equals as long as they don't have to live near them. In the Southeast, white people are willing to live near black people, but are not going to treat them as equals. That's how it is. And there's this strange race awareness that exists in the South amongst blacks and amongst whites. It's an uneasy sort of truce. Everybody knows this. Everybody knows this reality because it's everywhere. You see it all the time. I mean, here in Lagos, it's the same way. You talk to a typical black person and the issue gets to race. Well, first of all, they'll bring it up. They don't think twice about it. They're the most race realist people you ever run into. And they will say things like, hey, I'd rather you give me an opinion on it than this other guy because I ain't going to trust a black guy. It's the weirdest thing. They'll tell you they'd rather work for a white guy than a black guy because the black guy is trying to prove something, but a white guy, he just wants to get work done. You know, that they have these kind of attitudes, and it's just so common. You see it throughout the South, the American South. And so, you know, I spent, like, playing sports, I wrestled. The guy who was in my weight class, we had A team and B team, so we'd wrestle every week to see who was going to be on the A team. He was a black guy. I mean, and you wrestle the same man for 6 years, you know each other as well as two men can know each other without having a sexual relationship. You know, you just know everything about it. And as a result, you know, you come into this world with a real understanding of diversity. And that's why a lot of people are kind of, they don't believe me when I say there's never been a time when I wasn't a race realist. I was always a race realist because I grew up in a world of race reality. And that's not unusual. But you're right. A lot of people in our thing got mugged by race realism. And a lot of them kind of go the wrong direction with that. Instead of saying, whoa, wait a second, I was simply wrong. I was taught wrong. I was conditioned wrong. They sometimes kind of go the other direction and maybe embrace attitudes that are not always healthy. And my view is that, look, I don't have anything against black people or South Asian people or East Asian people or any of these other people. They are what they are. They can't help it. I'm not going to hold it against them for being their nature. That's immoral. But we have to be cognizant of those differences, and peaceful separation is best for everyone. It's best for me. Now, if it turns out that it's not ideal for some other group, well, they have to make the best of it. That's up to them. Ultimately, what's best for me and my people is what I care about most. But I don't want to, you know, it's one of those things. I'm willing to compromise. I'm not willing to harm other people just to get a tiny little benefit. You know, I'm willing to trade off these things. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to take that approach. In a country like America, where we really don't have nationalism, you guys have nationalism. That solves a lot of problems. We don't really have that. And we have to talk about the ugliness of race because it's been made so ugly by the people in charge. And so we have to come at it, I think, with more humanity and humility in order to make our points.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. Now, of course, I have said it before that America can develop a sort of nationalism. It's going to be, I don't know if it's feasible, because it's a very big place. And that's another thing Europeans, I don't think, understand about America. There is no quote-unquote America. There's Virginia, there's Ohio, there's all of these different places. They all basically form something which could at some point become a nation, maybe groupings of them. But America is just too big to be talked about in a single cultural sense. There is linguistic unity, true, but not cultural unity, not even, I think, ethnic unity. If you read something like Albion's Seed, you realize even the founding stock was very different from each other. Even, English Americans who first settled the continent were very different from each other. And that's something that Americans are going to have to contend with as the process of their ethnogenesis progresses in the next 100, God knows how many years. But the problem of racial integration is going to have to be solved, because just living in this multicultural empire in such great proximity to each other is just not feasible. And that's not a good future, I would say. But let's think of something fun. Let's think of something good.
One quick thing on that point. There's a great book that if people could read, because it's real short, it's 250 pages, and it's called American Nations. It has maps, and it shows the people who flowed into the New World, how they flowed across the continent, and how those voting patterns and educational patterns, all these cultural patterns, have persisted. You know, Portland, Oregon is not Portland, not knowing Portland by accident. You know, we have Portland on the East Coast as well, you know, and you look at these maps, and it really is it's a great presentation of it. And what it, the general thesis is that America has always been many nations. Just we have certain things in common. And the great conflict that we have today, what's really damaging our society, it's actually bringing the empire to its knees, is that the people in charge don't really have any respect for our own for the diversity of the people over whom they rule. They talk about it, but they don't believe it. And you know, if we restored free association and closed the border, most of our problems go away. We would self-sort and things would generally work out okay. I mean, it sounds rather simple the way I put it that way, but we'll need a revolution to make it happen. But you know, that's the reality of it. But I do think there's one other thing while I'm thinking about this, is that there is sort of an American mutt that is an ethnic identity. Anytime I've been in Europe, everybody spots me as American. I can dress like the locals, but they know right away. We have a different way of walking, apparently, than other people. And we are louder. And, you know, at events, you know, whenever I ask a question, everybody turns around and it's like, oh, yeah, there's the ugly American. We knew he would be here because we just have a more direct way of doing things.
Yeah, this is other Americans have noticed that they feel observed when in Europe because it's the accent. It's the accent of it. And I think maybe I should be a little ashamed because people tend to assume I'm American because I am a loud person, somewhat obnoxious, and apparently I have some sort of strange walk which makes people think I'm an American. And of course I look, I don't know, is this an American look? Who knows? Anyways, we have donations and people have been donating on Entropy. Now, naturally, more is always appreciated. We have questions. We have questions, Z. There is Gadius Maximus with 10 American dollars asking about Stone Toss allegedly made 2 million on NFTs. Those are non-fungible tokens, unless I'm very much mistaken. How does Z-Man feel about that as a workaround for being targeted financially by the system?
Yeah, I think I've said all along, I mean, the wrong way for us to look at Bitcoin is the libertarian way, that, oh, this is going to overturn the dollar and all this stuff. That's not. It's not going to do those things. What it can do, though, is allow us to work around the system. There's lots of smart people who are working on ways to make it simple for normie to be able to do Bitcoin stuff. And that really is the key. You know, the usual suspects, you know, they control the iron bank. You know, countercurrents is literally being banned from using the financial system by one man, the guy who runs MasterCard. I mean, think about that.
Yep.
And
it's not just MasterCard, though. The entire credit card industry is in on it.
Yeah, well, MasterCard controls the blacklist that all of these guys use. And so, I mean, it's a small number of people who really are controlling this, you know, this choke point. But if there's workarounds, then who cares? Let you have your, you know, and there, it, I think that's really the great thing about.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, the black is like,
they give you this illusion of competition. Like, are you going to use PayPal? Are you going to use Visa, American Express, or MasterCard? But it's the same thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's all the same.
Different system. Heads of the same fucking gay ass Hydra, isn't it?
Yeah, if the guys who actually process the credit card at the retail side, they pay a fee to have access to the merchant network, which is controlled by the consortium of banks. Mm. So, you know, that's why they all charge the same fees and all that, because it's, you know, they're not bringing any value other than, you know, they have a web widget or they have some little gizmo at the cash register or something like that. But the fees are all the same, and it's that blacklist is controlled by MasterCard. And they originally, it's like everything else that started out as, hey, this will help prevent fraud. We'll you know, these fraudsters all run around and we'll get a profile of it. And we'll say, this guy, he's a fraudster. Instantly, the usual suspects turn good intentions into something bad. You know, that's what they do all the time, is they take our virtues and turn them into vices. You know, a good, you know, being responsible and saying, hey, we're going to try and do something about fraud immediately becomes a political weapon. And you know, that I think it will help a lot. I mean, the whole NFT thing, I think, is kind of hilarious in a way, because, I mean, you know, it just, I mean, what are you going to do with this? I mean, it literally is a thing that has no value. Well, let me put it this way. It's a thing that has value only because we're all playing make-believe, you know. But
you could say the same thing about cryptocurrency. Like, we're pouring vast amounts of electricity into this something, which, what is it ultimately?
Yeah, I mean, really, money has always been the power to shoot somebody. I mean, that's really what it is. Yeah. It's a monetization of force.
So I'm going to amend the iron law of the ghetto from fuck bitches earn money to fuck money earn power. And I think, and Gadius Maximus rightfully points out, you could say the same thing about dollar bills, but hey, dollar bills, they have the American government behind them. And so they are still accepted at the bank, as Z-Man would love to put it. So is crypto for the time being. So I'm not really bashing the stacking of crypto or investment into crypto. I'm just skeptical as to its political utility, you could say.
Yeah, I mean, I hold some care of crypto, but, you know, it's right. Not, it's like anything else. You know, I hold a little gold, I have a little silver.
Yeah. Personally, I prefer to invest into things which I can hold in my hands, or at least have the person holding it for me within leg-breaking range. So, we have more donations. We have a donation from DesiMac, who asks for $3 American, if we did not have guns, we would be run over with pigs as well. How are you going to kill a wild pig with a skateboard or a knife? Well, I think our forebears managed with spears and sticks and stones. If they could do it, I mean, we could probably do it, but a gun is very simple to use. I think it's simpler to use than a boar spear. Maintenance might be a bit of a hassle with a gun, whereas a boar spear, you know, you can always make a new one. Your opinion? I mean, I like the whole hunting thing, but I don't think the hunting should be the... It's like someone says, the Second Amendment is not for hunting, right?
Yeah, I mean, I hunted most of my life, I guess. I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. I haven't really, even about the last 10 years or so, I kind of... You know, you get a little... There's a hassle factor to it, you know, being outside and all that. There was a time when I was sitting there duck hunting and it's raining and I'm thinking, you know, I could really be doing something else right now. But, you know, as you get older, that's what happens. But yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, we actually have a wild boar tradition here in the American South. I mean, the University of Arkansas football team is actually, its mascot is the Razorback. And we have those wild boar all over, because, you know, as soon as pigs get loose, they become feral rather quickly. You know, Hawaii has been trampled by the damn things, and you know, there's whole sections have been deforested. And you know, pigs are a funny animal. You know, like in New England, they actually change the ecology. They blame excessive pig farmers or use of pig farming for forcing sort of this move west that started off because the pigs churn up the soil, and so they started reducing the amount of arable land. And so people had to move to look for new land. I mean, there's a book called Changes in the Land.
Are we talking about feral hogs churning land?
They'll do it, but also just regular pigs, because, you know, you more pigs you raise, the more space they have to take up. And, of course, the economics of it means, hey, I'd rather grow pigs than grow crops. But unfortunately, you can't go back from growing crops to pigs to crops without a huge investment in fixing the land, because I guess it's the way the hogs churn up the land. So, I mean, it's kind of maybe not the greatest theory in the world, but it's a book. It's called Changes in the Land.
Counterintuitive, because farmers will invest a bunch of, you know, money, effort, gasoline into churning the land with tractors. You'd think that hogs churning up the land wouldn't be such a bad thing. Maybe they do. Maybe it's their droppings which are bad, huh?
Yeah, that could be it. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't know a whole hell of a lot about pig farming.
Yeah. Well, that's something to think about. Yeah, feral hogs. I mean, I've been chased by a wild boar. This is a story I'm never going to get bored of repeating. I went hiking alone like a fucking moron, and I woke a wild boar up, and it chased me downhill, and I got away, obviously. We have ABC donating $5 American. Kyle Rittenhouse would have been given hard time without video footage proof. all alt-right rallies should have people with the only mission to video record the hotspots and upload them in real time, including body cams and drone footage. Thoughts? Well, Z?
I don't know. I think one of the good things about the whole COVID stuff is that it put an end to any kind of in-person organizing for a while so that we can kind of think about this a little bit. But yeah, I think one of the problem at our side, I mean, you know, the alt-right guys, you know, that whole scene went away. So we don't want to dwell on that too much. But there's a good lesson there, though. A lot of what they did wrong was to assume that they could hold the other side to their own rules. And that's never going to happen. You know, the other side, you know, they're not a rules-based world. They look at the world and say, well, we can do whatever the hell we want because we're on, you know, the side of history. So I think future organizing in real life for us has to be, well, what's the point of it? Is the point to make a big public scene, or is it to get our guys together to socialize and build fraternity? If it's the latter, well, then you do what you need to do. You lie, cheat, and steal. You say, well, we're gonna have a venue, you know, in the United States, and what we're going to do is we're going to form an LLC called the Puppies and Kittens of Israel Society, and we're going to use it to register at the event so that if somebody wants to protest it, they're going to have to say, we hate Jewish cat owners. You know, I mean, make it so it's so hard to optically bear to pull it off. And do what you have to do. You know, you lie, cheat, and steal so you can get together and have your socialization.
Or you just don't announce it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, like, exactly. I mean, that was the huge mistake of the alt-right guys, that they kept trying to provoke responses, thinking that that was a good idea. No, it's not. Yeah, so I think this break is a good thing.
I was thinking part of it could be, you know, an attempt to bring back the spirit of the 1930s, you know, street battles between Antifa, between communists and the, let's call them the base squad, the Sweetie Squad, or the good guys. It's I don't think this is what determines the degree to which political power can be wielded. It's questionable how much good it did back then, let alone right now. So and as for recording rallies or events, a lot of our people are cagey about having their faces recorded. That's not something you want to do if you want to build trust. And another thing, even if you don't record someone's face, there is biometric expertise which can be used to identify a person, even if you do not get a clear shot of their face. Now, it's very expensive, and it's very hard to get an expert who can actually positively identify a person using this technique. But I have not used it in my legal practice. My father has, back when he was a criminal judge. He has approved such things, and they are really fucking expensive, but they are effective. So I am suspicious of any attempt to record the audience or, you know, the main body of participants in dissident right events. Unless you somehow get the consent of everyone involved, they are okay with being recorded. I'm going to go with ixnay on that.
Yeah, the recording stuff would only work for people who are, you know, protesters or something like that. I mean, if I was holding an event, you know, if I was going to have an event somewhere, yeah, I would be prepared for three things. One, I would, you know, understand that, hey, you know, you need to get people there. You need to talk about this to some degree in a public way. So word will get out and they'll try and attack it. So you make sure that you prepare, you know, use subterfuge so that they can't start calling the event and saying, well, you know, did you know this, the Israel Puppy Society, you know, that's going to be very difficult for them. And, but the other thing is, though, is that when you have the event, is that you need to make sure that you have some sort of security, you know, that you have people there. Yeah, you have to pay for it. That's the way it goes. But the other thing is that you are prepared to call the police first. Our side has this weird, I don't know, this is just a general thing in America. Anyone who thinks of themselves as right wing, it's like they think that a courtroom is full of poison gas, that you just can't go in there. And it's completely backwards. You know, we should be the most litigious people in the world, because the left has actually built enormous amounts of precedents in the United States that we could use. I mean, this Charlottesville debacle, people don't realize how the opportunities that are being there. If that judge, you know, he allows this thing to go to a jury, which maybe it already happened, I don't know, but it goes to the jury, and the jury finds that these guys were all wrong for having this thing. You can use this same principle to go after every Antifa event. And not only that, you can also layer on there torturous interference. Because as soon as somebody shows up and tries to break your contract with the venue, that's what they're doing. And that you can go into court. And all you got to do is get one of these knuckleheads into the court and say, I'm going to sue you. I'm going to take your stuff because you were there throwing rocks or whatever you're doing. That person will start getting chatty real fast. And these people aren't there on their own dime. They're financed by rich people. That's the ticket. You get a rich guy in court, he does not like sunshine. I have been in enough courtrooms with rich people. They do not like sunshine. They are not interested in being in a courtroom. And so our side should prepare it if we want to have, you know, if we want to exercise our God-given rights to be able to associate with one another. One of the things we have to be prepared for is set it up in a way that makes litigation easy. Cheap for us, expensive for them. Because the principles are all there. You know, there's a mountains and mountains of, in the United States, a precedence for this. Now, Europe is a different thing. And I think, you know, you guys have a different set of rules there. But, and also I've noticed that Europeans, you guys have less of you have the Antifa show up. I've been to Frody's events where they've shown up, but nothing like the crap we've got here.
Depends on the country, really. I mean, I've witnessed Norwegian Antifa in Oslo, and I've witnessed the glory of the Norwegian police tossing an Antifa into the back of the police van, like a sack of potatoes. I loved it, loved every second of it. Here in Macedonia, the Antifa are a sad collection of losers and drug users who, you know, they've had me on their shit list since 2012, and they live like 50 meters. I live like 50 meters from their headquarters, and they're not going to do shit because they're just afraid of, I mean, they could, I guess, jump me, but they haven't got the wherewithal. They haven't got the deep pockets for it. And I don't announce my movements, really. So, but in Germany, these people are basically an unofficial arm of the German Federal Security Service. So they are very toothy there. They are very dangerous. They are very well organized, very well funded. So it really depends. Like in America, you're not going to have an Antifa riot in, I don't know, Nebraska, but you're going to have these people burn down Portland. All right. So really depends on the country.
We don't have much of an Antifa presence here in Lagos because, right. You know, the locals ain't going to put up with that. They see they see those guys show up and they see victims. That's what they see. So, you know, there was some church militant group had an event here last week, and the city tried everything to prevent them from happening and all that. And like four Antifa members showed up to try and protest it because they're not idiots. They're scared. I mean, these are white boys from the suburbs. You know, they're not going into the city to cause trouble. And because they know what that means around here. You know, I've often joked that, you know, if I was going to have an event, I'm going to have it in the middle of the ghetto. And I know how things work around here. It would be the most safest place because, frankly, the locals would be so spooked by it. They'd say, well, we're just going to leave those weirdos alone. But, you know, the other guys try to come in and do something about it. Oh, they'd be meant for a terrible surprise.
You really think that the locals, the blacks, would be afraid of, let's say, white nationalist event?
They would. It would be very weird, and they would just avoid it. They have the same sort of instinct that, say, like, you go off onto the Serengeti. You know, the predators, because you're not something they're used to seeing, you know, you're in some sort of flamboyant outfit or whatever, they'll say, well, you know, I don't know what this is. I'm going to leave. This happens all the time. And if you're a white guy and you go into a place like Baltimore, especially like if you're a working man, they generally leave you alone. They'll steal the stuff off your truck maybe, but they're not going to rob you because there's a weird sort of morality that happens in the ghetto. They understand that they need you to keep stuff running, you know, so they'll leave the working guys alone. Because they know that those guys keep the plumbing working and the, you know, all the stuff happening, and they'll steal your stuff off your truck maybe. But if you're there guarding your truck, they're not going to, you know, assault the guy guarding it. You know, they just look for, they're opportunists for the most part. And anything that's really weird. I mean, like, I've driven through the ghetto a million times, and they double take and see a white guy, and they'll say, well, whatever. And that's it. But, you know, the cops here will stop you, too. I've been profiled many times. You cut through the ghetto, the cops will stop you. What are you doing? You know, it's just the way it is.
Yeah, white guy going to the ghetto is probably an international arms dealer. Well, and especially if, as you have described yourself, Rasputinian in appearance, I would certainly assume that if I were a policeman. We have, I wouldn't call it a question exactly, from Scott for $20. He says it's illogical to say that because someone lives under one set of laws, example, the restrictive gun laws of Western Europe, that they can't take an interest in the affairs of a place with a different set of laws. The Rittenhouse trial is about more than guns. It's about how compromised the legal system is. I don't know what to... I guess, the legal system of America could be of interest to Europeans, but I think that Z-Man already explained his position on that. Z, you got anything to add to that?
No, you know, it's funny that the vicarious American just can't let it go. I'm not sure if it's escapism or if it's just, it's a way to have an identity where one doesn't exist. I'm not entirely sure there, but something I've sensed, particularly among English-speaking, you know, the Brits, they become kind of hooked on America in a very weird way. And I think because maybe, you know, it's an identity they can kind of grasp onto, because British identity is under so much pressure. You know, to be a British chauvinist, to do the things that Brits always used to do, a big part of being British used to be, making fun of other people. I mean, British humor is based on making fun of the French, making fun of the Germans, you know, making fun of Americans. Well, you can't do this stuff now because you're a racist, you know. So I think maybe that's part of it. I don't know. I'm not making a lot of friends.
Point where basically they have to, I mean, this is not a bad thing. I love British humor. One of my favorite comedic scenes is from Blackadder, where he's trying to communicate with his jailer, who only speaks Spanish. And so they're trying to insult each other with pantomime. And this is, I warmly recommend people watch this. Basically, this guy goes through a whole song and dance just to call Blackadder a bastard son of a bitch. And it's the comedy derives from just in part how Neanderthal and filthy the Spaniard is. Then you have his German boss, who is everything you expect in a German from a British comedy series.
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, that the political, I forget who the comic is. I don't know. Some comic out there is complaining about, you know, all this multiculturalism and all the other stuff has made it impossible to be funny. You know, humor has always been about laughing at ourselves. I mean, even Jewish humor, which is very subversive, obviously, it's a, you know, minority perspective, but it's often Jewish humor mocks Jews. You know, there's a whole body of things of Jewish humor and Jewish literature that makes fun of and you know, subverts its own culture in a way. Yeah. And you know, it's just normal. But, you know, and I think the British, though, you know, they have such a great wit and a great gift for the language. Much like the Irish, you know, the Irish are much more lyrical. The British are much more satirical, and their ability to really lampoon other tribes has been, the hallmark of British humor. But it's also this confidence, this sense of what it means to be British. You know, that car show that was popular for a long time, the big, tall, kind of goofy looking guy with the toe-headed fella. What's the heck his name? Jeremy Clarkson. He's like
Top Gear.
Yeah, he's the British guy. You think, man, that's what it means to be British. You know, he's a chauvinist. He thinks that Americans are a bunch of buffoons. He thinks the French are a bunch of homos. The Germans, you know, are unfunny and rigid. You know, he has all these stereotypes. You know, and he does it in a way that's humorous. You know, and there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with cheering for your own team. But but it is now for Britain. I mean, look at that Clarkson guy. He's gotten all kinds of trouble basically just being normal. So. Right.
I've never seen a single episode of Top Gear, but people have sent me the clips where he has a tank run over a Yugo, and he declares it the biggest piece of shit on wheels that ever rolled on the surface on the earth. Having driven a Yugo, I tend to agree.
Hey, I have a Yugo story. They actually, when they started selling those in the United States, I guess it was in the 80s, I guess. I went to a dealership just as I was curious. I wanted to see what this thing looked like. And it was there, and the guy opened the hood, and parts fell onto the floor. holy smokes. And it was a terrible idea. But I wonder if there are any are still around. They're probably collector's items.
No, a friend of mine recently bought a used Yugo. And he's a young guy. He doesn't have much money. It's his first car. And like, look, whatever first car you're going to get, you're going to trash it. It's just one of those things, I guess. And better you trash this piece of shit than some vehicle of actual value. But he brings it over and I say to him, you spent 500 euros on this piece of shit. And I get into the passenger seat, obligatory banging my knee against the front plastic. And then I try to open the window and it's got one of those twisty handles, you know, on the old timey cars, and the handle just comes off. It's right in my hand. I'm like, what the fuck are we going to do now? And, it's I guess one of those things. It's a very low end vehicle, but he bought it for the nostalgia factor. I don't think they're being made anymore. I think the last series was made in 2004.
Well, that was funny is that the communists, the Soviets, when they wanted to start making cars, now there's the Soviets, you know, they had the Italians help them design the Soviet car, the Lada, which I think is after the Fiat. I want to say Panda or something like that. And it's like, you know, if you want something dependable, if you wanted something dependable, the last people you asked to help do that would be the Italians. You want something beautiful. Yeah, the Italians are just, you know, beautiful stuff, but they don't really care about reliability. And, you know, so, you know, why they did, you should have got the Germans to build them cars, but I guess that probably wasn't appropriate back then.
Well, you know, this happened a lot. So people may know that there's a brand of cars called Peglica, which is Polish, and they're basically just producing Fiat licensed. I think it's a Fiat 1300. And of course, Zastava, which produced the Yugo, also produced the Ficho, which is a knockoff of one of the earlier Fiats. And I think the Yugo itself is a copy of a Fiat compact design. Yeah, you're right about Italian design. I mean, even their high-end cars, the Ferraris and the Maseratis, they're just people are saying, you were talking about the Lada Niva Z. I think that's the Jeep, right?
Well, you had the Lada was what little sedan thing that was like a...
That's the Lada Samara.
Yeah, they made gazillions of those damn things.
Yeah, I know. I've seen a lot of them. The Lada Niva is a durable four-drive vehicle. It guzzles more gasoline than the entire nation of China, but it's going to survive a bolt of lightning and the entire engine freezing. They have one down in the Russian Antarctic base, which has been running for 50 years, I think. So you know, it's one of those things, I guess. But yeah, a lot of communist bloc countries just used Italian designs, especially from Fiat. I don't know the story behind that. At one point, I met the CEO of Fiat. Maybe I should have asked him. But yeah, you're right about the Germans. Now, if we could just get Italian design with German durability and a Japanese implementation of scale, a sort of an alliance between Italy, Japan, and Germany, if we could get one of those going, I think we could get... do great things. And that would be with regard to cars. Now, we have a lot more donations here, but I think that the Z-Man has a denunciation in store.
I don't think so. Who was I supposed to
do? You were going to denounce the millennial generation.
Yeah, the millennials. It's actually... It's an idea I was thinking about as a post, and it started out the weirdest thing. Someone in that age group was trying to explain to me why OnlyFans is a good idea, and I'm listening to this. I mean, it's the ultimate sort of bugman logic. But his reasons were, they apply. I've heard this explanation for all kinds of things from that generation. And you know, it's not their fault that they were conditioned a certain way. I mean, that's for sure. But then it got me thinking, well, you know, we do have this rather retarded generational politics where everyone's supposed to blame the boomers for things that they actually didn't do. You know, all the worst things in America were not done by the boomers. They were done by their parents. You know, the greatest generation was the one who passed all these stupid laws in this country. And in Europe, you don't even have boomers. I actually got curious about this, so I started looking this up. You know, Southern Europe didn't have a baby boom after the Second World War. Spain, Italy did not. Greece did not. Balkans, it's hard to know because the politics. But Austria had a little bit of one, and the French had a little bit of one, but it wasn't anything like what is America. The Brits had a baby boom at the end of the Second World War that ended in 46, but then their boom actually happened in the 60s. So their baby boomers are actually my age, not in their 60s and 70s. So,
well, I think it's not the same thing. I think it's not in reference to the boom itself, because if I don't think there is a Balkan baby boom, but there is a behavior profile of the archetypal boomer here in the Balkans. It's just generation later, but people born between 1960 and 1975.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Like, millennials are the boomer children, you know, which is ridiculous. Yeah. I've heard Zoomers say, you know, well, you know, my boomer parents, your parents are not boomers. Your parents are my age. That puts them in Gen X. Hell, some of them are even millennials, for goodness sakes. You know, they had kids early. And, but, you know, you start thinking about this, you're like, well, what, you know, I don't like generational politics because pitting one group of white people against the other is not a good idea. No more brother wars with this stuff. So, because in the United States, it's always about whites. You never, you know, if you see a commercial that features black people, which is all of them now, there'll be eight generations of black men. I mean, as a statistical probability, it is about 1 in 10 black men know who their father is. That's the reality of America. So, you know, these, you know, idealized black people where all the generations come together and love each other, you know, and all this stuff, you know, that gets sold. But when it's whites, everybody hates each other, and it's every generation, you know, is at each other's throats. And I hate that kind of politics. I don't think it's really any benefit to us. But that doesn't mean there isn't generational characteristics. There's certainly things about baby boomers, particularly, you know, there's a first wave, second wave. And, you know, the first wave is much more, because they're older now, they're very much attached to an old politics that has been gone for a long time. Then there's no point in arguing with them. The second wave is the griller cons. I just want to grill. I just want to go and watch sports ball, that kind of stuff. But their kids, their millennials, they're the children of what we called here in the States helicopter parenting, where they were raised in these safety zones. And the language, this language of safety and being protected and all this stuff, it's a very strange thing. And for someone who's a Gen X person who didn't get that treatment, we didn't get treated like little precious snowflakes when we were young. And it started happening, you know, but in my case, I was already in adulthood by the time it started coming along. It's jarring sometimes just how sensitive. Look, I've had millennial employees cry in my office. You know, I mean, it's a very hard thing to deal with a man who's crying. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, but it's a thing that we all in the business world, we kind of know about. You have to kind of tiptoe around these guys. The Zoomers, on the other hand, are just these sort of reckless, I don't give a crap sort of mentality. And it's, I don't know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but there's certainly generational characteristics that are worth discussing as long as we can not beat each other over the head with this sort of stuff, you know, and do the whole boomer bashing or Zoomer bashing or whatever it might be.
I think a big part of it is that people hear something said about their particular group. And this is not just in the, age group sense. I think this is also true of ethnic groups, maybe religious groups too, and they interpret it as a personal attack on themselves. You know, it's when someone says millennials are like this or boomers are like that, I think what this person hears is you are like that. And then they go into this is how you know, these things, or sometimes they actually seem to think that winning this argument that their generation is like that or isn't like that is going to improve anything. Like, I love Jim Goad. I respect his writing, but whenever I see one of his generational wars articles, I just skip it because the man is clueless on the question. And
well, see, Gen Xers,
another thing. I was reading this thing he said, like, you know, young people should be fucking. You know, we boomers, we fucked. Young people are not. Therefore, and I was like, okay, you can't just gloss over the whole woman question and the toxicity of the modern dating market like that. It's not a question of lack of willpower. You know, millennial men, we have the will. The problem is the field is just not the same.
Yeah, that is a tough thing for my generation to understand about the next generation, the younger people, and even especially with Zoomers. The Zoomers, I noticed, they have problems with what I would consider normal social skills. And I have very poor social skills. I you know, growing up in the underclass, I find being around middle-class people always very tiresome. All these little cues that middle-class people just take for granted. You don't see that in the underclass. The underclass is much more blunt. And, you know, it's simpler because most of the people in the underclass are stupid. So they just can't master the complexity of bourgeois life. But even me, I look and go, my goodness, these younger people, they seem to lack the kind of social skills that are necessary to deal with women. And that's a little bit puzzling to me. I struggle with that to be sympathetic to it. But I also think that, you know, reality is going to change things for a lot of people. I mean, you know, Gen Xers were lucky in that our generation's small. It's a small cohort. We're sandwiched between baby boomers here in America, millennials. Everybody talks about them. Nobody talks about us. There was never a time in my life where I thought being Gen X meant anything other than the fact that I get ignored and that's about it. That's, you know, there's no 80s nostalgia that I know of. There's no, you know, none of this stuff.
And what do you mean there's no 80s nostalgia?
Not really. Nothing like that.
I mean, the entire alt-right era was 80s nostalgia.
Nah, but these are a tiny group of people who were just noisy idiots online.
I mean, there's no real nostalgia. It was also the Trump phenomenon was in great measure 80s nostalgia. I mean, that's the thing. Trump was big in the 80s. Like, this is someone who had jumped the shark in 92.
But that's not cultural nostalgia. That's just a replaying of political stuff. I mean, Obama did the same thing. He replayed
the political stuff. You know, I mean, obviously Trump as Reagan has been analyzed to death. But, you know, this guy he is the guy in American Psycho that the American Psycho looks up to. I mean, this is like the yup. And you have that Ricky Vaughn character from the Wall Street movie. He's ginning up support for Trump. You have the fash wave aesthetics. People are talking about, oh, these people, they go to clubs and do cocaine. That's beast. And so it's like, to me, like, what the fuck are you people talking about? I mean,
Selection bias there. I mean, I honestly disagree with you on this. I mean, this is tiny little subculture that existed online only. When those guys went out in the regular world, they were perceived to be complete weirdos. That's why it fell apart. You couldn't take that internet subculture out into the real world because normal people are looking at this going like, look, dude, I lived through the 80s. No one dressed like that. You look like a moron back then. I mean, you watch 80s. I talk about this a lot when I get drunk on weekends and post on Gab. I'll go and watch these 80s music videos, and I laugh because if you dressed like that in regular America in the 1980s, you'd get the hell kicked out of you. You look like a moron. Nobody dressed like that. The girls would imitate some of the stuff, but the boys didn't dress like that. It was ridiculous. You know, and I even went back and looked at some old pictures of myself back then, and I'm like, yeah, I'm not misremembering. All my friends had the same haircuts we have now. We dressed in regular clothes. We dress like businessmen, basically. We button down shirts and trousers. You know, yeah. I mean that's what the problem was with the alt right is that it was an internet subculture that they thought was something real when in fact it was just an extended meme. And when it got out into the real world, it couldn't hold up to contact with reality.
Yeah, that's very interesting. But I will say there is a great degree of 80s nostalgia still present, and I think we should hunt it down and expurge it because, frankly, I'm sick of it. You're not accomplishing anything with this thing, you know, with the blue blazers and
Yeah. I mean, I think that understanding the characteristics of these different generations, and I don't really think the term boomer really works very well, because you have two waves there. Jim Goad didn't grow up in the flower power stuff. I mean, it's just a different world. I mean, if you were born in 1950 in the United States, you came of age, first you had the Beatles, and then you had, you know, the Summer of Love stuff, and things got a little darker. If you were born in 1960, still technically a boomer, you were wearing wide lapels and had a perm so you could have an afro, and you wore platform shoes. You know, it's a different world, you know.
Perms are coming back, though. You know, my Zoomer friends, they call these men, young men with perms, broccoli heads, and I tend to agree. In the ethno state, we will have no perms. All perms will be forcibly shorn off, and the proceeds and the hair used to make lampshades or something.
I mean, you think about it, though. The interesting thing about the 80s, though, is that I was talking to somebody about this, and it's actually worth talking about, because what I think for Gen X, the reason why people who lived in that time probably don't have as much of a generational connection is how fast things changed. If you went and looked at it in the United States, you went to a typical American high school and pulled out their yearbook in 1978, you'd see their prom pictures. We have these, I don't know if you guys have this in Macedonia, but it's called proms, you know, senior dances, you know, and all the men would be in these garish looking outfits. You know, they'd be wearing these ridiculous looking things. They'd have grubby looking haircuts and all that. 5 years later, if you looked at the same high school's yearbook, all the pictures would look like they're scenes from The Great Gatsby. Men would be in traditional tuxedos. Women would be in proper gowns. Everyone would be properly shaved and bathed and look like they could go out with adults. The world changed really quick, but that change didn't stick around very long. All of a sudden, the Cold War ended. The 90s came along. The Clinton mystique, the boomers really took over the culture. They spent a lot of time talking about themselves. And so it was really a very narrow window there for people of my age to celebrate yourself and your youth. You know, it was gone quickly.
I don't know. My high school has uniforms, so basically all the generations dress the same. So you're going to have to judge on haircuts. And I destroyed all photographs of myself from that period for very good reason. But yeah, for a couple of years there, every day I went around looking at girls in very suggestive uniforms. We have donations on Entropy. We're going to quickly go through them. K. Max McDonald says, Z-Man, how important is the fact that our rulers never do real jobs? The presidents of old were farmers, surveyors, and other jobs. What jobs did our current ruling class have growing up?
Yeah, it's hugely important. Yeah, honestly, I think one of the, since I'm making so many friends this evening, one of the problems in our politics is we have too many people who've never actually done an honest day's work. You know, if you want a speaking role, I said this about the guys who are starting the National Justice League Party. I said, you know what they should do? They should start a hot dog stand. Learn how to do that well. Run the damn hot dog stand for 6 months and open a second hot dog stand. You know, before you're going to start a national political party, learn how to run a damn hot dog stand. You know, I guess, and I say this as a guy who's been working for himself, a small businessman for 20 years. I worked in big corporations before that. And all my politics are informed by my observations in the actual world of people working and doing stuff. And so many of our politicians, in fact, none of our politicians have ever done real work. I wrote an article somewhere, maybe it was a tacky article, where I went through all these different people. None of them have ever worked, ever. They've never had a real job. How can they possibly know what it's like to meet a payroll? How can they possibly know what it's like to have sleepless nights when the money's tight? When, look, I've had periods in my life where I didn't take a salary so people could have a salary. You know, when you do those things in your life, then you have a real understanding of what life is like for your fellow citizens. But when you've been living off the tit of the government for your entire life, where every mistake is rewarded with more money, it doesn't matter. There's no wrong answer or right answer. You can't possibly know. I would have, if I was the Solon, right? The people are going to come to me for a reform. The first thing I'm going to say is that you have got to show 10 consecutive years of a W-2 from the private sector before you can hold public office. And it can't be at a government contractor either. It's got to be at a real company. It's infuriating to me as someone who pays his taxes as a businessman that these people have any authority over me.
Another big problem of it is that just the scope of actually doing real work is was just muddled, right? There's a bunch of companies posing as private companies, which are they're actually state enterprises, or parts of it could be real work, whereas other parts of it are completely false labor. And in my, you know, my years as an attorney, because I was actually doing personal injury stuff, I met a lot of people. And it was actual work for a time. And you realize that basically the bulk of the companies which pose as private, especially if they surpass a certain size, they are more or less part of the state, too big to fail. They are in with the, they are insulated from failure. And within these, like my go-to example is the telecom company. But if you look at it, the engineers actually running the telecom system, they're really working, right? Whereas the hens in HR or the parasites in the corporate suite, they're not really working, right? So you got to have a little nuance there. But yeah, none of the political class have actually ever run anything of note, right? That's the thing.
I think there's something else to this, though, and it kind of gets back.
Although to... I will say that at least Mike Painovich has been writing. What's his name? Mike Enoch or Mike Painovich. He has been running TRS, right? And he has experience in the information technology business. So to that end, I don't know. Like maybe that's a feather in his cap.
Well, circle back to the whole work ethic idea. You know, one of the reasons that I think Jim Goad says all these horrible things about millennials, and is to some degree justified in it, is that work, honest work, it makes you feel like a man. You know, I mean, it's one of the things we don't talk about is the beauty of work. I mean, I've written some posts from time to time about projects I've worked on, like fixing something on my truck or something like that. And I get all these responses from people saying, oh, yeah, I wish I could do this more, or do these kind of things. And I think we've lost in America this love of doing work, of actually doing things from a man's perspective. I'm not talking about from a female perspective. I'm talking about as a man perspective, because so many of those young people, millennials are not young anymore, they're middle age. Their entire lives were in office work and busy work and doing things that really don't have any value. And so they really didn't get that. You know, if you worked construction as a young person, you came away thinking, you know what, that's pretty cool to make stuff. And yeah, work in an office, but you're going to gravitate away from busy work in the office to actual work. You know, it's going to change your outlook because you want that feedback. You want that sense of accomplishment. So I think, you know, younger people have been cheated in a lot of ways by not being exposed to work and the beauty of it, the beauty of making something, of accomplishing something, and being able to look at it after the fact and say, I did that. And we've, in this country, we have cheated at least two generations of that, I think.
That's very interesting. Personally, I don't like working. I've tried working office work, don't like it. Tried working with my hands. It's slightly more tolerable, but it's still work. I'm only going to do it for money, essentially, and a lot more than is on offer right now. I'm going to be 100% Mediterranean on this. Work is a sin against the self, you know, kind of like masturbation, although I think it dirties the soul even more, dirties the hands horribly. Man is meant to live his life in pleasure, not in toil. And that is my position on it, and I will not consider changing it. People want us to get Jim Goad on the stream, but
you need to tell him. He needs to understand. I was just joking. I was having a little fun.
We were of course, obviously, just pulling your leg there, Jim.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's it's one of these things, huh?
Oh my goodness! You know,
yeah, I don't really expect him to listen to my shows, but here he is. Here he is, and the chat just froze up on me, and I missed most of the conversation. But we did have a denunciation list, didn't we, Z? Yeah. I mean, I built this as we're going to jointly denounce the controlled opposition. Now you've been observing this group of people, these false, populists, these populist ink you've been telling them. Let's go with that for a little bit.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's a funny thing in American politics, in that it's because it's so commercialized and it's an enterprise, you know, it's a business, that as soon as someone comes along with something that seems to get an audience, immediately all these imitators float in, not with any genuine concern for the issue, but they're just there to make a buck. And, you know, that's, I think, the real problem in America is that politics is an industry, and it comes with all the problems of an industry. And one of the, I forget what his name is, but a basic right-wing principle is that truth can never be exposed to the marketplace, not because it can't withstand the marketplace. It's that we don't want to expose the truth to the marketplace. We don't want 50% plus one deciding what the truth is of certain things, moral truths, you know, transcendent moral truths, or, you know, the rules of society, or even, you know, physical truths. You know, we have now turned physical truths into a debating society. 50% plus one in theory have decided that a man's penis is imaginary, and that you're assigned a sex at birth. So, I mean, this is insane. This is not true. I don't care if a majority of people think that your sex is assigned at birth. That's not true. And so there's certain things that just should never be exposed to the marketplace, but that's what happens in politics. It becomes a marketplace of political truth. And so someone comes along and points out that working class men in America are getting hosed by the system, and he gets a big audience, then a whole bunch of grifters show up and start selling versions of it, you know, cheap knockoffs of it. And then the message gets polluted and nothing happens of it. I mean, Trump had a lot of defects, but to his credit, he was willing to talk about things that no one would talk about. Now we have all these other people who are talking about it in ways that are all sanitized and safe. So now we really can't talk about it at all. I mean, it's turned out to be almost a curse in a way. And so all these guys, although some of them, the J.D. Vance guy, I always tell people, you know, let's wait and see, because sometimes, you know, when people are trying to feel their way around in the world to try and find the right answer, you know, they step on the landmine and their world changes. And that may be J.D. Vance. I don't know. And some of them, you know, are mean well and maybe are not too smart. I don't know. But it's one of those things that, you know, as soon as somebody's making money off of their ideas, you know, in the political space, you always have to be suspect, you know, because you just never know.
I mean, J.D. Vance specifically, and all of these people, these based people running for office, I don't know, they stink of not just grifterism, but really controlled opposition to me. And I mean, controlled by intelligence and counterintelligence services. Now, I think one of our favorite punching bags here in the dissident right are the neocons, and they've been trying to slither their way into the treehouse too, through this national conservatism grift through Yoram Hazony and all these people. And you have actually gone into the viper's nest the first time around. With Yoram Hazony and all these people, would you care to share your impressions of this particular type of glowy?
Yeah, you know, it's always amazing to me. It's like I think you and I were once talking about this guy, Hanania, whatever.
Yeah, Richard Hanania.
Yeah, all of a sudden this person just appears and has a huge following, you know, and Hazony is kind of the same way, you know, there's a big marketing campaign around him. But it was funny when I went there, you know, at Zion Fest 3 years ago, whatever it was. Down in DC, it was interesting. I mean, first of all, they had their security was top notch. These were former Secret Service guys were running it, so that's the level of connection that they have. Now, Peter Thiel's a rich guy, you know, so he could afford it. But it was funny. I you know, all the little
not just rich. I mean, very well connected with the security apparatus. Not just a question of money. It's a question of, are you friends with the, you know, three-letter agents?
Oh, yeah. And it was funny. I mean, the thing that I found it most amusing is that there were more people there who wanted to talk to me than some of the people who were there as big shots. And I learned something interesting, that there's an underground there of people who consume our content, but they do it in private. They have private meetings. I found out that there's a group of people who have listening sessions where they listen to, you know, dissident podcasts. They get together and they have drinks, and it's a socializing thing, you know. So that was interesting. I didn't know, and I still don't understand, all the different color small hats that get worn. There was this group of guys that had these like wicker small hats on, which I could, for the life of me, I kept trying to ask people, is it what the hell these things were? So that was, you know, there was something, it was a part of the world I didn't know about. And, you know, the small hat itself. I mean,
wicker, you were talking about a kippah, right?
Yeah.
The Jew hat.
Yeah, exactly. And these guys are a little like tan wicker deals. I couldn't figure that one out for the life of me. And, but you know, there's a bunch of different flavors of that stuff going on. And
it was heard of a, you know, wicker Jew hat.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe it was the summer. I mean, who knows? But the and it was funny though, is that there was more media people there than there were attendees. That was the other thing that really jumped out. It was like a trade show. You know, have you ever been to like a trade show? That's really what it was. It was all these people. They're handing out, you know, they're exchanging business cards and trying to, you know, make contacts. And it's just a very clubbiness, but I don't think Hazani's not getting anywhere. I mean, I think one of the things, you go and look at his like YouTube channel, because there's nothing. I mean, it's highly produced content, you know, a big backing, and nobody has any interest in it. It has no constituency. And I don't think that the neocons are really trying to wiggle through that door. I think they're trying to go through, re-ingratiate themselves in the Democratic Party. They seem to be palling around with, there's a lot of them in the Biden administration. So that's, I think that's the door they're going through, is they think that, you know, that'll work for them. But I mean, they're like a drug resistant virus. You know, I mean, I don't know how you get rid of them.
Right. For my part, I think that the neocons are not stupid enough to leave the American right without some measure of poison, without some subversion, because if there's going to be any sort of movement which would be lethal to neoconservatism and its related heresies, it would come from the American right. Personally, I think that their attempt to slither back in or poison the well of dissident thought is through Strasserism, through the Clermont Institute. So basically, a lot of these based and red-pilled people that we've been hearing about writing at the Clermont Institute. I mean, there was this big expose on what's his name, Yarvin, about how his father and brother were federal agents. And suddenly this guy is over promoted after dusting off his blog after how many years in the dark. Real Hanania vibes there, real Hazoni vibes there. All three of them also belong to a very special group of people which tend to have high degrees of, pedigree collapse and long noses. So that's something to think about.
Well, the thing is that the neocons don't like the Clermont guys. There's a feud there. There always was this weird West Coast, East Coast, Straussian bullshit going on. But now
it's basically the same thing. You know, it's like I say I have disagreements with Jim Goad. But to someone who genuinely opposes both of us, we are the same thing, right?
Nah, this is a different thing. The Bulwark and the Dispatch both had strong denunciations of all the Clermont people. There's a big, big feud going on that side of the camp, side of the world. And it's understandable because the people who are financing the neocons, the Bill Kristol world, you know, I jokingly say that this guy believes he's Cyrus the Great, you know, but it's a bunch of different, it's the losing hand. You know, I think what's happened is that people have started to realize that the Bill Kristol world, that the sun is setting on that crowd, and because they're intellectually weak, they're very stupid people, they're very foolish in their presentation, and so I think there's part of that. But I there's a big dispute there, and I think, you know, there's always been this within the Jewish intellectual life, there's been this sort of German versus Eastern European rift, and it's a physical rift, but it's also a cultural rift. There, you know, these are, frankly, the Clermont people are just simply smarter than the other team. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's obviously true. They're better read. The stuff that they write is more deep and more penetrating. It's worth reading. There's nothing that those other guys is worth reading. It's just boilerplate crap. That's all it is. And I think, you know, what my observation being at various Jewish events, you know, like Hazani's events, or I used to go to Mencken, which was a ton of Jews there. there's a group of them that have a very high regard for intellectual rigor, and they have the opposite of intellectual laziness. I mean, it's an unbridgeable gap. And I think that's really what's going on there, that the really smart Jewish guys are looking down at the rest of them saying, we're not going to be associated with this riffraff anymore. You guys are just too dumb for us. So I that's my read anyway.
That's very interesting. And of course, Populist Inc. Are we going to name names, or do they know who they are?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really follow a whole lot of that stuff, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, I to some degree, I'm kind of disconnecting from that kind of politics in general. I don't want to be on Twitter. You know, anybody who thinks that their politics can be conducted on Twitter, I'm sorry. You know, that's wrestling with midgets, and I'm not interested in that. So, and it's one of those things. I mean, a lot of my readership are people who are academics. And they have, you know, sent from time to time, they've sent me emails to this point, is that they like the fact that they can have a place where they can talk to other people who are not chirping morons. And I think there's something really there. I think that's something we can sell, is that we are a much more deeper, more thoughtful, and much more learned political movement than all the other competitors. And we want to attract smart people. And so let's not get in the gutter with the dumb people.
Yeah, I have tried selling Countercurrents, and of course this show, as creating a high culture, basically a salon where you can come and discuss the big ideas. This is my vision for the future of the writer's block, that these shows are re-listenable, not just because Nick and Z have a good conversation on just how crap the Yugoslav automotive industry was, and it was real fucking crap, but also because you can come here to discuss the intelligent things like cultural differences and nuance between America and Europe. This is something of real value. Now, you mentioned Twitter, and I've suspected for, well, let's call it a month, maybe two, maybe more, that Twitter might be a full-on glow site, by which I mean that Twitter then is not real. That there's very little real people on Twitter. And if someone is Twitter famous, they have a bunch of followers. These are basically botnets being activated at the whims of Jack Dorsey in particular, but other interested parties who may purchase botnets, who might purchase influence with Jack over on Twitter. I think Twitter is the political platform most amenable, and may have been specifically built for this reason, to falsifying mass appeal and mass support for positions or people or figures. And therefore, it is a known spawning ground and a known breeding ground and stomping ground for precisely the not just controlled right, but everything that the ruling class likes to astroturf. So my central contention here is Twitter is astroturf central just due to the ease of manufacturing massivity for the support of a certain idea or person. Would you agree with that, or am I just gone completely off the deep end with the paranoia?
Well, a couple of years ago, there was a group of British researchers who said that they, in their analysis, they determined that there were about 600,000 bot accounts on Twitter that they could identify, in a trustworthy sense. And they think that they're controlled by Twitter. Now, they were hinting around at it, but that actually makes sense, because really what's going on is this sort of enforced consensus, this manufactured consensus. And, part of the menticide, this war on our sense of reality, is that all these media operations are constantly trying to blast us with all this information. And that's what Twitter does. There's nothing about it's real, for sure. The trending stuff, there's times I've seen stuff on there, because I don't have a Twitter account. I just bookmark some pages. Mm-hmm. And, I'll see this trending stuff and I laugh. I'm like, there's no trend here. It's ridiculous. But they're just trying to introduce this stuff. And I think it's deliberate. But this is not just Twitter. YouTube, a lot of it's fake. Facebook. There was a guy who actually, you can still find his videos on YouTube. He showed how Facebook's ads are fake. They're all fake. Yeah. He actually created, it's a, the Digital Bagel Company, where you can have bagels delivered to your email box. Well, that's obviously ridiculous. He created this entire fake company, and he starts getting clicks. You know, he's all his likes and all this stuff. And he says, it's obviously fake. This is ridiculous. This is a nonsensical business. So I think a lot of that is, I mean, all of it is fake to one degree. But what happens, you know, it's the old, was it Conquest Second Law, that any organization that's not explicitly right-wing becomes left-wing? Well, they've all become taken over by left-wing fanatics at every level. And so they're constantly blasting left-wing propaganda. You know, it's the whole cultural Marxist thing. You know, take over the centers of cultural production. And therefore, you can then disconnect people from the white power structure. And then something magical happens and we have the glorious future. And
but in this case, it's not really a taking over institution. I think what's happened with Silicon Valley and the social media in particular is they constructed this power structure from the ground up. And I think that maybe the goal was, maybe they pivoted to this, as these people say, but maybe the goal was from the very start. And that's why they got all their funding and their patents from DARPA and the Pentagon and all this shit to start these specifically so they could more easily astroturf these things and control the culture through social media. That's my thing. Has it been fake from the get-go? It's not a problem of just a bunch of bots, but that it's all fake, and that its purpose was always to be fake and produce fake shit.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that. I'm a big fan of evolution in all sorts of things, because I think, you know, I've started many projects in my life in which I had a set of intentions. And as I got into it, I realized that, you know, I didn't know everything I needed to know, and things changed. And before long, I ended up at a place I didn't expect. Look, I didn't expect to be here. I didn't start out to do this. It just kind of happened. This is true of most things in life. And I think most of these guys just started a business because it was a quick way to make money. I mean, it was really what it was about. I mean, I know people who have looked under the hood of Facebook code, and they say that it's so bad that it's a miracle that it runs. You know, because they just was cheap, get it up, you know, just to make money. So I think a lot of that is just that. But I think the bad guys come flowing in. You know, it's like anything else. You know,
or maybe the guys just get turned bad. You know, they get offered something. You know,
this cancer on our society, these people, they've always been here to some degree. But what's happened is that we're no longer good at regulating them. We don't do what we need to do to keep them under control. And so they're running wild and we're paying the price for it. And it's, you know, I mean, it's going to get worse. So it's not like we're at peak crazy or something like that, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know if these organizations, I mean, maybe they are, I don't know. I mean, I think in a lot of ways that our ruling class is riding a tiger right now. I don't think they really have control over this forces they've unleashed. I mean, look at COVID. They didn't start out to end at this point. They don't know how to put the damn genie back in the bottle. They've turned COVID into a religion.
That's interesting. I've heard a lot of takes on the COVID thing, that it was planned from the get-go. I tend to agree with you that the COVID stuff is just emergent behavior on the part of basically a bunch of incompetents. But it could go either way. We could be proven wrong. And whereas I'm far more skeptical of the, I don't know, there's something about Twitter which seems specifically designed to bring out the worst in human beings. And by definition, it's not like Facebook or, you know, MySpace, for those of us who grew up in the times of dinosaurs, where you're supposed to find people you are already friends with in real life and connect with them over the internet for whatever reason. It's Twitter is specifically designed for you to congregate around causes, around products, around fandoms with strangers. And then you have right-wing Twitter, you have Balkan Twitter, and Balkan Twitter is really fun. It's probably the only reason why I'm still there. I don't know. It's what Z-Man said. We don't really, you build up a thicker skin just slinging ethnic insults at each other all day, I guess. You have fashion Twitter. I've been looking for poop Twitter, but there is no poop Twitter, apparently, even though there should be a poop Twitter.
It's all in German.
Right, right. I should brush up on my German. I should be looking for Scheiße Twitter. But it seems designed to suck you into this make-believe vortex, which might as well be full of make-believe people. And I don't know. I'm really skeptical about that. But we have donations, Z. We have donations. And of course, if you want me and the Z-Man to answer your questions, you're going to have to pony up some dough. And better pony up on entropy, because for whatever reason, the DLive chat keeps freezing up on me and I cannot track donations there. I'm going to read some of the entropy questions we have received, and feel free to ask some more. We will be going into overtime since we're having just so much fun, Z. We have K Max McDonald for $10. He says, Pat Casey mentioned Lyndon Johnson's $1 trillion civil rights bureaucracy for this mess. Is it like a jobs industry for professional black complainers? Jamel Hill and Joy Reid sound like Malcolm X 60 years ago. It never ends because of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. That's what keeps it going.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's certainly a welfare industrial complex. You see that around the ghetto. I always tell people, there's a lot of people get rich off poor people, and it's probably always been true, I suppose, to some degree. But I'm old enough to remember when people used to call social welfare programs riot insurance, that's what it was. It's an industry. I mean, and I don't really think that's the biggest problem, though. I mean, the biggest problem we have in America is we have a mass media that's making everyone insane, including the people in charge. The best thing that we could do if we were sensible is we'd shut down all the cable outlets. We'd turn off Facebook. We'd turn off Twitter, all the other social media outlets. And shut it down completely. Say, that's it. We're done. We're no more of this stuff. Go outside. And, we would be like mole people. Everyone, all these people would be outside rubbing their eyes and seeing the sun for the first time.
Yeah. That's very, it's an interesting phenomenon of just how social media and the omnipresence of screens and phones is warping us. I mentioned before I have Zoomer friends, and I've been mentoring them because they lack social skills, as you pointed out. And I've been trying to teach them some of that because, I don't know, I'm just a good guy. And I recently learned that I'm the shortest person in our little social group. I'm not particularly short. I'm 5'10". But I did not notice it before because all of them are walking, hunched over. And even though I am the shortest among them, I look the tallest just because I walk erect, and by that I mean, straight backed, not the other thing. Although that frequently happens, I still got it, and it was just amazing to me. Like, you guys are all taller than me, yes, but you don't look taller than me. This is maybe more important than really being physically taller, that you look taller. It's just a tiny way in which our bodies are warped by these machines and by this unhealthy way of living. It was amazing to me. Yes, people are making fun of that. Yes, I do walk erect around town. Yes, I do scare the women when I pass by. That's my go-to. Ha ha, I made a funny on the show. And really, really, the thing is, how did we allow this to transpire? And it's like, you stare at these phones, and I do it too. I just work out. I have, there are special workouts you can do to keep your back straight and to avoid this curse of becoming hunched over. A lot of guys actually do walk hunched over, and they lose like an inch or two of height because of it, to the point where someone like me just appears taller than you. And of course, I do walk with my chest puffed out too, so that's a very powerful visual effect. And the reality of it is that's not real. It's nothing behind the phone is real. I mean, it's real in the sense that it exists, but its existence is not meaningful to us in any way or shape or form. It's I don't know what to call it. I guess it's with the world. People are keep on saying the world is crap, the world is tough, but is it really? I mean, it's not that bad. I think people just want the flashing colors and strobing lights over the real life. And I like real life. I still like real life. I may be one of the last people to last generation to prefer real life to the life behind the computer. And that's the thing.
There's definitely a weird thing that older people, I don't know if that's true. I see boomers tapping away on their mobile devices all the time, or here in the US, Facebook is mostly for old people. And, that's they use it for. But I don't know. I've never really been a guy who's embraced my digital environment that way. I mean, I'm online a lot. I have to check my comments, for example, because I check moderation, but I do that like once an hour and I see if anything's stuck in there. And, and I'll spend time on Gab usually if I'm free time having some drinks. But otherwise, I don't use my phone for pretty much anything that other than I don't even use it as a phone. I turn the ringer off. You call me, I'll never answer. So, I mean, it's, it's one of those things. I mean, I always tell people, if you need to reach me, send me an email. I do check my email on a regular basis.
That's another thing. I was reading your article on why you don't answer your phone, and like telemarketers, that's not a thing in Europe. Someone, yeah. I mean, I'm going to cross myself, knock on wood, put the spit to the side, but we don't have that problem. And I think if you tried that in Macedonia, the guy you're calling would call all his friends and say, don't buy this motherfucker's products on any and under any circumstance out of spite. Because I don't know, how is that allowed in America?
It is a mystery in a way, because, you have this, these big phone companies with all this stuff. I mean, I've gotten 25, 30 calls in a day asking me to buy an extended warranty for my vehicle, something like that. And everybody gets it. It's and in fact, you have apps now to block this stuff. And I thought, you know what? I just turn the sound off and I don't have to worry about it. And that's it. I mean, I have a mobile phone for the sole purpose of being able to make a call if I need to, or text someone if I need something. But otherwise, I'm not that important. No one needs to get a hold of me. There's never a time where there's an emergency going on and someone says, hey, we got to call Z. It's never going to happen. I mean, if there's a real emergency, call the doctor or call 911 or something, But, so I have, I funnel everything through my email. I do the same thing for the site as well. I try not to really, like a Telegram, stuff like that. I try not to do too much on those things. Send me an email through the site. I generally reply to everyone. I do it every Saturday. I sit down and I go through 150 emails that come in during the course of the week. And, if it's an emergency, well, you probably have dialed the wrong number.
Yeah. The reason I have a smartphone is because my colleagues forced it on me. I apparently needed it for work. I used to have a dumb phone and it worked just as well. Now I just have this. Basically, it feels like a ball and chain sometimes. We have $14 from Michael57DE. And he says, the problem with crypto is the problem with any internet-based currency. You need access to the internet, which the government can remove at will for any individual or member of a proscribed group by requiring positive identification to access the web and an approved score to access. Hail the gods. Well, that's one way of looking at it. Z, have you got any opinions on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've said before that the reality of crypto or any kind of alternative currency is that it exists as long as the government will allow it to exist. I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, the guys who can drone strike you, have the ultimate say. And, I don't think it'll ever come to that. I think a lot of our rich people look at crypto as a backstop for their own concerns about what's going on. I don't think for a minute that rich people are not deeply concerned with the problems that they that are happening. I just don't think they I don't think they understand what to do about it. I think some of them don't, are just more concerned about profiting from it. But I do think there's a fair number of our oligarchs are fully aware that there's serious systemic problems, and that keeping crypto as a backstop probably isn't the worst thing for them. You know, just as a way to transfer money, because they, you know, these guys do business in China. You know, that's the thing. I mean, I've done business in China. Getting currency out of the damn country is there's an art to it, and you know that you have to know people. Crypto makes it a little simpler, you know.
That could be it. I mean, that could be the most impactful aspect of crypto, just this ability to move capital around the globe without too much interference. But, you know, I recently looked into the Serbian legislation on crypto and how they're going to handle monetization. And they have imposed an income tax to income derived from trading crypto. And the question is, oh, how are they going to tax us? Well, at the point of conversion to, you know, normal money. So that's, I call it the, I'm blanking on the term in English. Anyways, so that could be a problem with crypto. That's all, you also run out of electricity. You cannot. And we are possibly looking at electricity shortages as our leaders become increasingly unhinged with regard to carbon and power and stuff like that. So there's that. We have a $3 donation from Archie. He says, joke, how do you get a one-armed Moldavian out of a tree? Answer, wave. That's good. I like it. That's a very amusing remark there, Archie. Any Moldavians in chat, you are going to have to pay for the privilege to insult Archie and have him read it out. And if our mods would just dump the entropy link in there. And Desi Mac with another $3 says, have either of you heard about the marches in Chicago where the crowd is shouting they want communist revolution? Thoughts and what might they mean?
Z. Well, I haven't really seen much of it. My guess is they're just morons. I mean, yeah. It's funny about the whole protest thing. These are manufactured. You know, they have all these not-for-profits get these people up. And most of them, I mean, they don't know what they're saying. They're just there, you get walking around money. So I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, the best thing that could happen in Chicago is it burns down.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of looking at it. I've not heard of marches in Chicago. If these people want communist revolution, well, they already have it. Now the commies won. It's recently there was some kerfuffle here in Macedonia about victory over fascism. And I said to them, congrats, you won. You defeated fascism. Now enjoy the world that you've created. You know, you guys won. Yeah, we are defeated. We, the fascists, the evil, you defeated us in 45. You deplatformed us from Facebook and YouTube and all of these places. We are financially deplatformed. I'm running this show on a Chinese gaming website known as DLive. And, you know, there is also Odyssey, which is significantly better, and we have 53 people watching there, which is an improvement. A lot more people should be on Odyssey, because I think it's the superior platform. Pretty soon it's going to have more stable streaming, I think. But we're not on the major platforms. We're skulking around like thieves in the night. So you beat us. Now enjoy the world you made. This is what I say to people. That's my go-to comeback. And I'm just going to refresh the entropy page once again. And I think we can end this unless there are new questions.
Yeah,
there's another one, but it's not a question. It's a piece of advice. How do you keep blacks out of your backyard? Answer, hang one in your front yard. Well, I haven't heard that one before, Archie. Well, thank you for the $3 American.
Yeah, I got to wrap this up. I got to go. I got some things to do.
Okay. And Z, it was a pleasure having you on the writer's block. I'm just going to read out. I'm sorry, guys, if you sent messages on DLive, but the chat just freezes up for me and I cannot read any of them. We have two Ninja Guineas from Alaska Chaga. Thank you for that, sir, and for your fine products. I've been scrubbing my butt with your fine soap, and it has never been so shiny before. 132 total lemons from Giant Squid. I'm sorry if you sent any messages, Giant Squid, just the chat was unusable tonight. 100 lemons from Gadius Maximus, and I can read your message, Gadius. He says, thanks, Z-Man, for keeping tabs on the neocon crowd for us. Well, we're going to keep on doing that, Gadius. 100 lemons, which is, I think, a diamond from Hadrian, was right. Hadrian was indeed right. Yes, there should be a wall between England and Scotland. 20 lemons from Bartleby. 14 lemons from Slog. 10 lemons from Johnny5K. And 1 lemon from Spartan Superior. And that is... that is the sum of donations over on DLive. No donations on Odyssey today. That's that, I think. So this has been the Writer's Block with the Z-Man. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Jovi. And I hope you had a good time. I certainly did. So we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.